are listening to Radio Albion. This is a narration of three essays that were originally published on my Substack that cover the murder of Henry Novak, the sentencing of his killer, Vikram Digwa, and the specific government policy that helped bring about Henry's death. If you enjoy these essays, please consider following me on Substack. Part 1. The Murder of Henry Novak. As 18-year-old Henry Novak lay bleeding to death from multiple stab wounds, police officers attending the scene restrained him, handcuffed him, and arrested him on the directions of his killer. Despite his protestations and the fact he was bleeding profusely from his wounds, the officers attending the scene only removed the handcuffs from Henry after he had lost consciousness, at which point they attempted to resuscitate him and called for an ambulance. Despite an air ambulance arriving shortly after the call was made, Henry could not be resuscitated and was sadly pronounced dead at the scene. On December 3rd, 2025, Henry Novak, a first-year student at the University of Southampton, had been out celebrating with his university football team. Evidence presented at Southampton Crown Court proved that Henry had been behaving responsibly during the evening's celebrations. A toxicological assessment was presented that showed that his blood alcohol level was less than the legal drink drive limit. As the evening drew to a close, Henry decided to walk home alone along Belmont Road in Portswood, Southampton. He was described as being in good spirits and was captured on his phone singing to himself while sending Snapchat videos to his friends. Just before 11:30 p.m., Henry Novak crossed paths with Vikram Digwa, a 23-year-old Sikh man. Digwa was armed with two knives, he was openly carrying a shasta, a traditional Punjabi weapon with a 21-centimetre, 8-inch blade, and was also carrying a kirpan around his neck beneath his clothes, a smaller ceremonial dagger that is typically 5 to 23 centimetres, 2 to 9 inches. After a brief altercation, Vikram Digwa stabbed Henry Novak 4 times, once in the chest, twice in the back of his legs, and a 4th stab wound was discovered on Henry's lower body. Henry Novak also sustained a wound to his jaw, consistent with being slashed across the face with a knife. The wound to Henry Novak's chest was a severe puncture wound and was likely the cause of his death. However, the wounds Henry sustained to his legs were arguably more crucial in painting a picture of what happened that evening, as both of the wounds were in the back of his legs, clearly being inflicted as he attempted to escape and climb away from his attacker. As Henry attempted to flee, he climbed over a bin and a fence, and neighbours who were awoken by his cries reported hearing him shout that he had been stabbed and was dying. From the evidence presented, it is clear that Vikram Digwa had aggressively pursued Henry, stabbing him numerous times whilst his back was turned and he was attempting to escape. Due to the commotion, numerous residents living within earshot rang 999 and the police arrived at the scene shortly after 11:30 p.m. to find Vikram Digwa without any injuries and Henry Novak bleeding to death and begging for medical assistance. However, Digwa told the attending officers that he was in fact the victim and that Henry Novak was a drunken racist who had attacked him in an unprovoked incident. Digwa accused Henry Novak of initiating a drunken racist attack and falsely claimed that Novak had assaulted him and knocked off his turban. But this was all a carefully concocted tissue of lies. Digwa had deliberately taken his hair down from its tight bun so that it fell forward over his face and gave the appearance that he had been assaulted. What's more, Digwa later claimed in his statement to the police that Henry Novak had grabbed his hair and forced it into his eyes, which made him stab out in self-defence. This was enough to convince the arresting officers, who have yet to be named, that Digwa was the victim, and despite his stab wounds, Henry Novak was the criminal who needed to be arrested. One might ask at this point, how on earth could officers mistake a dying man as the aggressor, and why would officers handcuff and restrain a man who was clearly bleeding heavily? However, it gets worse. As the arresting officers physically held Henry Novak down, he fiercely protested that he had not initiated any confrontation or physically attacked Vikram Digwa, and repeatedly cried out to the officers that he had been stabbed. However, despite his protestations, the officers attending the scene continued to restrain Henry and refused to remove the handcuffs until he was unconscious. And none of this is conjecture, nor is this merely the recollection of eyewitnesses. The whole incident was recorded by CCTV and doorbell cameras. An 18-year-old white boy mortally wounded, desperately running down the street, attempting to escape, as he was being actively and aggressively pursued by his non-white attacker. Yet the white boy was the one to be arrested when police arrived. But CCTV footage has revealed even more about what really happened on the night in question, with footage showing Digwa stood immediately after the incident, with his hair still neatly tied up in its turban. The footage proved that Digwa deliberately took his own hair down before police officers arrived, exposing his story of being assaulted as a calculated fabrication created in order to manipulate the police. And when the police did finally search Vikram Digwa, officers found Henry's phone in his side pocket. Not only had Digwa not called the police or the emergency services for help, but he had stolen Henry's phone and prevented the real victim from calling for life-saving assistance. Digwa's behaviour was hardly that of an innocent man who had been the victim of an assault. Instead, it is what you would expect from a cold-blooded killer who wished to misdirect authorities by manipulating evidence at the scene of the crime in order to present himself as the victim rather than the aggressor. But initially, the police could not find the murder weapon, the 21cm Shasta knife. And that is because Vikram Digwa's mother, Kiran Kaur, had removed it from the crime scene. Doorbell camera footage captured Kaur retrieving the knife from the place where the attack had occurred before filming her carrying the weapon away from the crime scene and back to the family home on nearby St. Denis Road. Police later raided the home and recovered the bloodied blade. It was covered in Henry Novak's blood, had hairs from Digwa on it, and Kiran Kaur's DNA was also found on the sheath of the knife, proving she had physically handled it. By the time that Henry Novak was pronounced dead at 12:30 a.m. on December 4th, 2025, he was the victim of a non-white killer, the anti-white establishment, and the two-tier justice system. Obviously, the police officers attending the scene of the crime were partly responsible for Henry Novak's death. Had they listened to him and carried out the most basic of investigations, they would have found out he was telling the truth, simply by assessing the crime scene, taking note of the trail of blood, or by performing a basic check of his body. It would have been clear that Henry Novak was the victim and that he was fighting for his life. The police clearly did not care for the well-being of Henry Novak, or the truth of what really happened. All they heard when they arrived was the word racist. Their training kicked in, and the immediate response was to arrest the white man, regardless of all the evidence at hand. If nothing else, this case illustrates just how anti-white the police really are. They would rather a white boy bleed to death in front of them than be seen to publicly disbelieve the testimony of a non-white man who was claiming to be the victim of racism. But the two-tier justice that helped bring Henry Novak's life to a sudden end isn't just a recent phenomenon. In fact, the legislation that helped pave the way for Henry's death dates all the way back to 1988. This is because despite carrying two knives in a public place, Vikram Digwa was doing so legally. Had Henry Novak been carrying those exact same blades, he would have been breaking the law and would have faced up to 4 years in prison. But how did this come about? How is it possible for a non-white man to carry two such weapons legally? Well, quite simply, Vikram Digwa is a Sikh, and that's all that matters. When looking at the law in relation to the carrying of bladed articles, the foundational law prohibiting the possession of blades or sharply pointed articles in public can be found in Section 139 of the Criminal Justice Act, 1988. However, the law explicitly carves out several statutory exceptions. Section 139(5)(b) of the Act creates a specific statutory defence if an individual is carrying the bladed article for religious reasons. What's more, the law even extends these exceptions to allow such weapons to be carried on school premises and in educational properties, permitting Sikhs to lawfully enter schools and universities with knives. But the law goes further. The Offensive Weapons Act 2019 amended the 1988 Act to expand protections for Sikhs following a ban on large curved blades that came into force after a marked rise in knife crime. Section 141(b) of the 2019 Act explicitly names the kirpan, ruling that it is lawful to possess the weapon not just for strict religious worship, but also for ceremonial, sporting, or historical reasons. Section 47 of the Act also creates an explicit legal exception for large traditional curved swords, such as the shasta, or large ceremonial kirpans exceeding 50 centimetres. In short, Vikram Digwa was walking the streets of Southampton with two knives, but doing so totally legally because of his religion. In effect, successive British governments willingly created the very conditions that made it possible for an armed Sikh killer to stalk the streets legally. These laws are implicitly anti-white and are a clear and blatant example of legislation that is discriminatory in a way that favours ethnic minorities and immigrants. In this case, the legislation carves out an exception that elevates one ethnic group above all others by means of creating privileges that grant the advantaged ethnic group a set of rights not enjoyed by others. In this case, Sikhs are granted the advantage of being lawfully able to bear arms in public places. Conversely, whites are placed at the distinct disadvantage where if they are found to be in possession of similar weapons, they can be arrested and subject to criminal action. But Vikram Digwa not only knew that the law was on his side when it came to the possession of two deadly weapons, but he also knew that the police would side with him as soon as he used the word racist. This case yet again proves that individuals from ethnic minority backgrounds know exactly how to game the system. The mere use of the word racist by an individual from an ethnic minority group is enough to ensure that any power structure, especially when that structure is an arm of the state, will immediately side with the accuser and round upon the accused without any regard for evidence or context. The oft-made joke about playing the race card is no longer something to laugh at. Henry Novak died because his killer not only knew when to play the race card, but also because the police attending the scene were so eager to accept the race card that they were happy to handcuff a dying white boy as soon as that metaphorical card was presented. The importance of the race card is instilled in all children who come from ethnic minority backgrounds. They are told in nurseries, schools, universities, and in the workplace that the accusation of racism is the most powerful card they can play, as it has the power to grant them a litany of benefits in all manner of situations. What's more, the media relentlessly reinforces this notion, constantly drumming into people that racism is the greatest evil a man can commit, and that the victims of said racism deserve almost unlimited compensation. This has led to a situation where a clumsily chosen phrase is now seen as more egregious than a physical assault that causes tangible and provable harm. And clearly, the police enforce the law based on this crooked standard. But the police and the Crown Prosecution Service, CPS, also made another highly illuminating decision in the wake of the killing of Henry Novak. Both Vikram Digwa and his mother Kiran Kaur were arrested and charged and are now on trial at Southampton Crown Court. Vikram Digwa was charged with murder and possession of a bladed article in a public place, and Kiran Kaur was charged with assisting an offender and possession of an offensive weapon. These are standard charges, and neither Vikram Digwa nor his mother were charged with racially aggravated offences. It would be unthinkable for a white man to attack a Sikh, chase him down as he was fleeing, and for the police to investigate the case as anything other than a racially motivated attack. What's more, race does come into the case, as Vikram Digwa proved categorically that he was aware of the racial aspect of the attack, and that the issue of race was on his mind at the time of the killing, as he was recorded mentioning race to the police, and even tried to frame his victim as a racist attacker. Yet curiously, the police and the CPS chose not to add racial aggravation to the charges. By adding racial aggravation to a criminal charge, the police and the CPS fundamentally change the way the suspect is prosecuted and sentenced. Most notably, a person found guilty of a racially aggravated offence faces a significantly longer maximum prison sentence than the basic offence would carry. For example, a basic common assault carries a maximum of 6 months in prison, but a racially aggravated common assault increases the maximum penalty to 2 years. But the extent of the two-tier justice affecting this case goes far further than legislation enacted by Parliament several decades ago. More so, the two-tier justice evident in this case is not just limited to the way police investigate crimes and treat suspects differently based on their race and ethnicity. This case illustrates that there is systemic anti-white discrimination at every level of the British establishment, and this affects society as a whole in a number of ways. One effect of this systemic anti-white discrimination can be seen in the mindsets that were shared by both the attacker and the officers attending the scene. But it extends further, right through every tier of government, through all state institutions, and completely dominates the mainstream media. So all-encompassing is systemic anti-white discrimination. That it could be rightfully said that every tier of the British establishment is in some way culpable for the death of Henry Novak. Take a moment to imagine the outcry there would have been from the media and politicians if Vikram Digwa and Henry Novak's places were switched. Imagine a situation where an 18-year-old Sikh boy lay dying in handcuffs as police refused to help him after he had been stabbed by a white man. How do you think the government and the media would have responded to this? How would the police have responded to this? Do you think the officers who attended the scene of the crime would still benefit from anonymity? The answers to these questions are obvious, and anyone pretending that they are not is either lying or spent the entire period of time surrounding the George Floyd case hibernating in an underground bunker cut off completely from the outside world. Had Vikram Digwa died of stab wounds whilst laying in police handcuffs, it would have been front page news for weeks. Every single MP in Parliament would have had something to say about the matter, including the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition. What's more, the police would have issued long grovelling apologies, and the officers in question would have already have been arrested and be facing criminal charges, and rightly so. If the races of the victims were reversed, it would also be likely new legislation would be drawn up and pushed through Parliament at breakneck speed, the new statutes being publicly dubbed as Vikram's Law by the press. But as the victim was white, only two MPs are on record talking about the case: Callum Anderson, the MP for Thurrock, and Heidi Alexander, the MP for Swindon South. What's more, when invoking the memory of George Floyd, one can only imagine the level of protests and public disorder that would ensue if a black boy had died in similar conditions to those Henry Novak endured. Britain would have seen weeks, if not months, of violent protests that would have no doubt been supported in one way or another by journalists and politicians. There would have been no special courts convened after those disturbances, no fast-tracking of cases, no pressure from the police in order to force defendants into entering guilty pleas, and certainly no judges with a vested interest in passing unduly harsh sentences. If a black boy had died in these circumstances, the country would have burned, and we would have been told that the fires were a necessary force for change. But interestingly, it isn't just the mainstream media, the government, and the establishment that have been happy to ignore the blatant inequalities highlighted by this case. Curiously, many supposed right-wing thought leaders and traditional conservatives have been silent when it comes to the murder of Henry Novak. This is because the killing of Henry Novak doesn't fit the inherently multicultural narrative pushed by many who are associated with the counter-jihad movement. The message pushed by these people is similar to that of mainstream conservatives and is both clear and consistent. They believe that multiculturalism can work and is welcome. However, what stops multiculturalism working as well as it could is militant Islam. Essentially, they believe that Islam is the spoke in the wheel that prevents the British people from riding off toward a rainbow-filled, multicultural utopia. As the murder of Henry Novak doesn't fit the narrative of a Muslim attacking a non-Muslim, the case is sadly being ignored by many self-styled truth seekers. The Counter-Jihad Brigade and many so-called traditionalists have painted Sikhs as a positive example of multiculturalism, citing their contributions to the UK as a great example of how non-Muslim immigration has enriched the country. The case of Henry Novak doesn't fit that narrative, and as such, it has been quietly ignored by many. However, for those who are concerned about the rising tide of anti-white violence and how such a trend will get worse as the demographic changes in Britain accelerate, this case will no doubt evoke a mixture of emotions, most likely extremes of anger, sadness, and anxiety. Yet again, a talented young white man has had his life cut tragically short by a non-white attacker. But this time, there is the added issue that the victim would have been likely to survive had the police who attended the scene given him the medical help he required. Instead, they restrained him and handcuffed him at the behest of his killer. Further to this, reports now circulating online have theorized that the knife wound to Henry's chest caused him to effectively drown in his own blood, a process compounded by the way the police had restrained him. Whether this is true or not, only time will tell, as the trial of Vikram Digwa and his mother Karen Carr is still ongoing, and more information will likely be available after the jury delivers their verdict, which is expected sometime around mid-June of this year. From what we know so far, the treatment of Henry Novak by police was far worse than what occurred in the George Floyd case, but the difference in the establishment's response to those two cases could not be more stark. But what eclipses the tragedy and injustice of this particular case is the fact that it is not an isolated one. This case falls comfortably within a clearly identifiable pattern where non-white offenders are treated differently when their victims are white, to the way white offenders are treated when their victims are from a different racial group. This is the essence of two-tier justice, which by its very nature is an example of injustice. And this case highlights two-tier injustice in almost every way imaginable. The response of the arresting officers, the fact that the attacker knew that the best way to avoid the consequences of his actions was to play the race card, the framing of the case by the media, the government ignoring the case, the silence from the police. It all highlights the breadth and depth of the systemic anti-white two-tier justice we live under. And it must be remembered, This case doesn't just reflect the modern-day political status quo and so-called woke sensibilities. It reflects years of anti-white policymaking and attitudes by successive governments, the establishment, and the media. Post-World War II governments have knowingly passed legislation that has created an ethnic totem pole that places certain groups at an advantage and others at a disadvantage. As Henry Novak was white and Vikram Digg was a Sikh, that ethnic totem pole created a situation where arresting officers were immediately more likely to believe one of the two above the other, with deadly consequences. Not only did Vikram Digwa have the right to bear arms, a right not shared by his victim, but because of his ethnicity and his use of the term racist, the police immediately took his side without a second thought. This form of anti-white bias has been dismissed by many in the media and the establishment, either denied outright or even supported as a so-called necessary means by which to bring about equality. But what does equality look like in reality? Well, in this case, the system's version of equality looks like a dead white boy with his hands cuffed behind his back as his smirking killer stands watching, enjoying the full protection of the police. Part 2. The sentencing of Vikram Digwa. On June 1st, 2026, Vikram Digwa stood in court waiting to be sentenced for the murder of Henry Novak. His sentencing followed a highly publicised trial at Southampton Crown Court that concluded 4 days earlier on May 28, 2026. At the conclusion of the trial, Vikram Digwa was found guilty of both murder and carrying a bladed article in public after a jury of 8 women and 4 men came to a unanimous decision after deliberating for 24 hours. Judge William Mousley, KC, sentenced Vikram Digwa to life imprisonment with a minimum term of 20 years and 190 days before he can be considered for parole. This is commonly reported as 21 years because he had already served 175 days on remand, a figure that is taken into account when a sentence is passed down. He was also given a 2-year sentence for carrying a bladed article in public, which will run concurrently with the sentence for the murder of Henry Novak. During the sentencing, Judge William Mousley paid tribute to Henry Novak as a much-loved, kind, hard-working and ambitious young man, devoted to his family and with a bright future, before telling Digwa, "You robbed him of all those he loved, all the things he cared about and liked to do." The judge then went on to condemn Vikram Digwa for the wicked lies he spun about Henry Novak and his outrageous claims that he acted in self-defence, which were not only made to police at the scene of the crime, but which Digwa maintained throughout the trial and that formed the basis of his defence in court. These comments would be expected in any sentencing that took place after the conclusion of a murder trial, but what most people will be more interested in is the judge's comments on any possible racist motivation that Digwa may have had. However, Judge William Mousley did not attribute any racial motivation to Vikram Digwa when it came to the murder of Henry Novak, nor did he describe Digwa as a racist. In fact, the court concluded that the attack was an act of murder driven by a weapon obsession rather than any racial or religious motivation. What's more, during the closing speeches made at the conclusion of the trial, the prosecutor, Nicholas Lobenberg KC, explicitly stated to the jury, "It is not a case about Sikhism. It is not a case about racism. It's a case about murder." The police, the Crown Prosecution Service, CPS, and the prosecutor all completely ignored the issue of race and racism. But during sentencing, Judge Mousley did mention race and ethnicity, but not in relation to Henry Novak's death. Judge Mousley stated that Digwa's false claims of a racist attack had stirred up racial tension in Southampton and across the country, which have made many Sikhs worried about their safety, before going on to explicitly state that Digwar's actions did not reflect the wider Sikh community. Here we have a case of a white boy being singled out and fatally stabbed by a Sikh, and when police arrived at the scene, that Sikh immediately played the race card. We know with complete certainty that on the night of the murder, Vikram Digwar was thinking about two things: killing someone and race. Digwar fatally stabbed a white boy, and when police officers arrived at the scene, he faked being assaulted and immediately accused his dying victim of carrying out a racially motivated attack in order to shift the blame for the altercation onto Henry Novak. What's more, we know that Digwar's tactics worked, and we know this not thanks to court documents or a second-hand retelling of events, but because we now have the police body cam footage. The body cam footage is widely available in full and is extremely harrowing to watch. As Henry Novak pleads for his life, one of the arresting officers mockingly replies to him, "You've been stabbed? Whereabouts? I don't think you have, mate." The callous disregard shown for Henry's life by the officers attending the scene was spurred on by Vikram Digwar, who continued to lie and repeatedly insisted that he was in fact the victim. Race undoubtedly played a major part in the death of Henry Novak, yet Judge William Mousley only mentioned the impact of race in relation to how the crime might affect members of the Sikh community. This is outrageous, but not unexpected, and not just because it is yet another example of how the system always manages to paint ethnic minorities as the victim class, but because it also affected the length of the sentence which was handed down to Vikram Digwar. Digwar received a life sentence with a minimum term of 21 years, which is around the average minimum term for a standard murder conviction in England and Wales. But how did the judge arrive at such a sentence? When a judge sentences a defendant in a Crown Court, they deliver their decision orally by reading out their official sentencing remarks. This is a highly structured legal statement designed to explain exactly how the final penalty was calculated. The judge follows a strict, step-by-step process required by the Sentencing Council to ensure transparency and consistency. Sentencing remarks always begin with a summary of the offence, before then establishing a mandatory legal starting point for the sentencing of that particular crime. In the case of murder, that starting point is life with a minimum sentence of either 15, 25 or 30 years. The judge then assesses any aggravating factors before taking into account any mitigating factors, and then delivers a final calculation and pronouncement. Judges will of course have their own political biases and feelings about a case, but they can't just pluck a sentence out of thin air based upon their own opinions. They must justify any sentence and ensure it meets legal guidelines. In this case, we are dealing with an adult who was convicted of a murder that involved a knife that was taken to the scene of the crime and was therefore available for use. These conditions would ordinarily lead to a judge selecting a starting point of life imprisonment with a minimum term of 25 years. However, that is not the point which Judge Mousley chose to start from when sentencing Vikram Digwar. Instead, Judge Mousley ruled that the standard starting point of life with a 25-year minimum term did not apply in the case of Vikram Digwar. The judge's reasoning was twofold. Firstly, Digwar had an automatic religious exemption, which allowed him to wear his smaller, traditional kirpan. Secondly, the judge reasoned that the 25-year starting point could not legally be applied in relation to his larger 21-centimetre Shasta dagger without proof that the knife was being carried with the explicit intent to commit an offence. Because Digwar wore the dagger daily for religious reasons, the judge reasoned that it was possible that he had a good legal reason for possessing it at the time the murder took place. Therefore, the judge ruled that the statutory starting point for sentencing was to be life with a minimum term of 15 years. The exact part of the sentencing remarks that deal with the issue of the knives carried by Digwa, one of which was used as a murder weapon, reads as follows. These are direct quotes from the sentencing remarks with the numbers preceding them matching the relevant paragraph notations found in the document.
10. You were sober, but were carrying a large Sikh dagger in a sheath attached to a belt over the outside of your clothing. It is a strict requirement of the Sikh faith to have a knife, called a kirpan, at all times. Generally, this will be a small knife, hidden from view, often on a length of cord and worn around the neck. You had that but, in addition, the large dagger in a sheath. You are a member of an order of Sikhs called the Nihang, who have a tradition of having a second knife, or kirpan, and that is often fully visible, believing that the guru will look favourably on that. You observed that tradition in your everyday life, at work and in public. However, it was not a strict requirement. That is borne out by the fact that neither your brother nor father, who arrived on the scene after you had stabbed Henry, were so dressed. According to Professor Gurnam Singh, professor of sociology and an expert in the field, over the last 30 years, there has been a trend towards younger people wearing a kirpan with pride in a desire to express their cultural identity. They see it as an act of resistance to being denied the ability otherwise to display their identity. 11. The privilege extended to practicing Sikhs of being allowed to be in public with a bladed article and, particularly in respect of the large dagger, a highly dangerous weapon, easily accessible to the wearer, brings with it huge responsibility. 30. I have to apply Schedule 21 of the Sentencing Act 2020 to identify the starting point for that minimum period. In this case, that gives a minimum term is 15 years. The murder did not involve taking a knife to the scene with the purpose to use it to commit an offence or to have it available to do so. It is possible that you had a good legal reason for having the dagger when you met Henry, although considering the jury's verdict, that reason must have come to an end after you removed it from its sheath. Neither was it a murder for gain. Whilst you did take his phone or even rob him of it, that was neither the purpose of the murder nor clearly a part of it, but I am sure it was a further trigger for what happened to Henry.
Judge Mousley's assessment of Vikram Digwa's right to carry two such weapons appears to be almost fawning. In some ways, the sentencing remarks seem almost contradictory, as in paragraph 11, the judge states that Digwa did not actually need to carry the larger blade, stating it was not a strict requirement for him to do so. However, the judge then waves away the idea that Digwa was carrying the blade for the purpose of committing an offence, an argument that would be highly unlikely to be made if Digwa was not a Sikh. Finally, the judge could only go as far as to state that it was possible that Digwa had a good legal reason for having the dagger on his person. However, that possibility was enough to ensure that the sentencing began at the lowest possible point. These three paragraphs within the sentencing remarks make it appear that even after the guilty verdict was handed down, Judge Mousley was willing to give Vikram Digwa the benefit of the doubt. Judge Mousley then assessed the aggravating factors, adding 8 years to the minimum term, taking it to 23 years, based on 10 severe aggravating factors. These factors included the wicked lies Digwa told police, the hiding of the murder weapon, the abuse of his religious privilege, the sheer brutality of the crime, Henry was stabbed 3 additional times as he tried to escape, the filming of Henry's suffering, which was a degrading act, and the fact that Henry was a vulnerable and unarmed victim. The judge then applied a number of mitigating factors that served to reduce the minimum term Digwa would serve. The judge reasoned that Digwa was 22 years old at the time of the offence and applied a reduction based on his age. Judge Mousley then cited Digwa's apparent previous good character, applying a further reduction because he had no prior criminal convictions. Finally, and absolutely outrageously, the judge then cited a lack of premeditation as a reason for reducing Digwa's minimum term, stating that the encounter between Henry Novak and Vikram Digwa happened very quickly and unexpectedly, in effect, ruling that Digwa did not pre-plan the murder. This resulted in the final length of the minimum term that Vikram Digwa would be imprisoned for before he could apply for parole being just 21 years. This seems outrageous, and many people are rightfully very angry at the length of the minimum term handed down to Vikram Digwa. This has led to numerous online commentators suggesting that the judge acted on a liberal bias. However, sadly, when reading the sentencing remarks in full, it is clear that Judge Mousley has followed the strict legal framework that he was required to work within. What's more, Judge Mousley has published his sentencing remarks in full, and they are available in PDF format and can be found online. It is at this point that it starts to become clear that the lenient sentencing of Vikram Digwa is not in fact due to one liberal judge or a single bad egg, but in fact due to systemic anti-white biases that exist at every level of the English criminal justice system. Take a moment to consider how the judge might have passed down a sentence if the races in this case were reversed. Imagine if a 23-year-old white man had been walking the streets late at night carrying not one, but two knives. Imagine further if that white man had then attacked a defenceless 18-year-old Sikh boy, repeatedly stabbed him as he was trying to escape, and then filmed the dying boy before lying to police about what had happened. It is highly doubtful that any judge in the country would go out of his or her way to apply mitigating circumstances in order to lower the minimum term served by the killer. But more crucially, no judge in the country could even select a 15-year minimum term as a starting point in such a case. That is because any white man carrying a knife could not benefit from the privilege granted to Sikhs under the law. But there is another factor at play here. If the races were reversed, it would undoubtedly be the case that the perpetrator would immediately be looking at a much longer minimum sentence, as neither the judge, the police, nor the CPS would have ignored the racial aspect inherent to the case. If a white man had chased down a Sikh boy and stabbed him to death, it would immediately be viewed as a racially aggravated offence, especially if the issue of race was introduced at the scene of the crime by the perpetrator. What's more, if police had not treated the crime as a racially aggravated offence, then public and political pressure would have forced them to do so. And in cases of racially aggravated murder, the starting point for sentencing does not begin at 15 years. Instead, the law automatically elevates the starting point to a 30-year minimum term, effectively doubling the sentence. Had Vikram Digwa been charged with a racially aggravated offence, and the judge then applied the same aggravating and mitigating factors listed earlier, Digwa would have faced life imprisonment with a 36-year minimum term, 15 years more than the sentence handed down to him by Judge William Mousley. At this juncture, it is worth noting that the entire notion of racially aggravated offences creates a number of inequalities in the law. Most notably, racially aggravated offences undermine the core principle of traditional justice that states that all human lives and physical well-being are of equal worth. However, hate crime legislation creates a power structure where two identical crimes can be treated differently depending on the supposed motivation of the perpetrator. In effect, this creates a situation where the victim of a hate crime and their suffering is held up by the state as more important than the victim of a standard crime. But it gets worse, as this inequality is compounded by the fact that the state selectively and disproportionately applies the charge of racial aggravation in a way that discriminates against white people. This selective application of such racially aggravated charges can be seen in this very case. As if the race of the victim and the killer were switched, the suspect would have undoubtedly faced the charge of racially aggravated murder. As a result of Vikram Digwa's minimum term being just 21 years, there has been a large outcry on social media. Outcry on social media is a common occurrence and doesn't always lead to change, but in this case, there are a number of notable individuals and even MPs who have publicly come out and questioned whether the sentence was fair and proportionate. One such person is Suella Braverman, the MP for Fareham and Waterlooville. Suella Braverman is a former Conservative cabinet minister who now sits with Reform UK in Parliament after her defection in January 2026. Ms. Braverman took to X and wrote the following.
I have written to the Attorney General requesting that Digwa's sentence be referred to the Court of Appeal because it is unduly lenient. As a former Attorney General myself, and as a Hampshire MP, I believe the judge's sentence does not reflect the enormity of Digwa's crime, lies and behaviour. I will keep fighting for justice for Henry.
Whilst the wording of the post is undoubtedly something many white Britons would agree with, it is interesting that Suella Braverman has made such a call. As she noted in her post, she is a former Attorney General, and as a result of that, she will of course have a good understanding of English law. As such, she will know exactly why Vikram Digwa received the sentence passed down to him by Judge Mousley. Vikram Digwa's relatively short minimum term was fundamentally based on two factors. The first related to the legality of carrying the two knives he had in his possession on the night of the murder, which resulted in the baseline sentence shifting down to 15 years. The second fact is that he was not charged with a racially aggravated offence, and as he was not charged with a racially aggravated offence, he could not be tried for a racially aggravated offence, and by extension, he could not face the higher sentence given to those convicted of a racially aggravated offence. These issues are not due to any bias from the judge, but due to larger systemic issues involving both legislation itself and how legislation is selectively applied. In relation to the carrying of the knives, the Criminal Justice Act 1988 and the Offensive Weapons Act 2019 both carve out exceptions for the Sikh community when it comes to carrying bladed articles in public. The Criminal Justice Act 1988 legally protects a practicing Sikh who is wearing a kirpan or carrying a shasta. The Offensive Weapons Act 2019 explicitly protects the right of Sikhs to possess, inherit, and supply larger ceremonial kirpans. It is worth noting that on the night of Henry Novak's murder, Vikram Digwa openly wore a large 21-centimetre, 8.2-inch ceremonial Sikh dagger, a shasta. It was fully visible and carried in a sheath attached to a belt, which was worn over the outside of his clothing. He was also wearing a small kirpan on a cord around his neck that was hidden under his clothes. Had a white man been carrying these weapons and then used them to kill an unarmed Sikh, the sentencing for that man would have started at a minimum term of 25 years, an entire decade longer than the starting point that Vikram Digwa faced at sentencing. What's more, had the races been reversed and had a white man stabbed a Sikh boy to death, the police and the CPS would have undoubtedly charged the suspect with a racially aggravated offence. Even if the police did not initially investigate the crime as a racially aggravated offence, it would be likely that the public, politicians and advocacy groups would have applied significant pressure that would cause the CPS to apply such an aggravating charge. Once found guilty of a racially aggravated murder, a defendant is subject to a much longer prison term. In fact, a judge presiding over such a case would begin his sentencing with a minimum term of 30 years, double that of the 15-year starting point that Judge Mousley began from when sentencing Vikram Digwa. Suella Braverman may indeed be acting in good faith by writing to the Attorney General in relation to the sentence passed down to Vikram Digwa. What's more, many people who support Ms. Braverman will no doubt be happy that she has taken such actions. And indeed, her actions in this case are a force for good. Pressuring the Attorney General to review this sentence will again expose the systemic two-tier justice found at every level of the English legal system and ensure the case remains in the public eye. However, at the same time, Suella Braverman does not seem keen to expose exactly why Judge William Mousley was able to pass down a lower sentence than most were expecting. It is extremely likely that Ms. Braverman has read the sentencing remarks from Judge Mousley. As stated earlier, they are in the public domain and have in fact been published in full by at least one newspaper. As such, Ms. Braverman will be aware of Judge Mousley's reasoning for the sentence and also aware that he was acting within the legal guidelines laid out by the sentencing council. She will also know that Digwa was not charged with a racially aggravated offence, so the judge could not add additional years to his sentence for an aggravating factor that he was neither charged with or tried for. In short, what Suella Braverman has done is a good thing, but what is more interesting is what she hasn't done. And Suella hasn't explained to her sizeable audience of more than a quarter of a million followers that the sentencing of Vikram Digwa was not simply lenient due to the sensibilities and potential bias of a liberal judge, but was in fact due to the judge following strict sentencing guidelines and applying the law correctly. The issue with the sentencing of Vikram Digwa is not one of a woke judge, but is in fact an issue rooted in anti-white legislation passed by successive governments that has created exceptions within the law that benefit ethnic minorities and create systemic two-tier justice that disadvantages Indigenous Britons. But this goes further than anti-white lawmaking. There is also the disparity in the way that ethnic minorities and white Britons are charged when it comes to interracial crimes. When a victim is from an ethnic minority background and the perpetrator is white, a charge of racial aggravation is far more likely to be applied than when the victim is white and the perpetrator is from an ethnic minority. Suella Braverman is not talking about these issues. But there is one other issue that Suella Braverman has also failed to mention. Southampton, the city where the murder took place, falls under the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Constabulary, which is run by Chief Constable Alexis Boone. Chief Constable Alexis Boone was appointed by Donna Jones, the elected Police and Crime Commissioner for Hampshire and the Isle of Wight. Donna Jones is a Conservative and a former colleague of Ms. Braverman, and under her leadership, the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Constabulary formally adopted what is known as the Race Action Plan. This policy, which was brought into force under the previous Conservative government, establishes a commitment to a zero tolerance of racism and dictates that the constabulary must be actively anti-racist in all it does. The Hampshire and the Isle of Wight constabulary's strict diversity policy will have heavily pressured the arresting officers into prioritising Vikram Digwa's false claims of racism over and above the issue of saving the life of Henry Novak. The inconvenient truth that Suella Braverman does not want to talk about is that it was Conservative Party policy which helped ensure Henry Novak's fate, and that policy was drafted and enacted when she was Attorney General. The fact is, both the death of Henry Novak and the lenient sentencing of his killer are due to systemic anti-white two-tier justice. Due to anti-racist policy, police attending the scene immediately took the word of Vikram Digwa over the pleas of Henry Novak, despite the fact it was Henry who was lying on the ground begging for his life and telling officers that he had been stabbed. The police are trained to take the issue of racism and racially aggravated offences more seriously than they would other crimes. This was clear on the night of Henry Novak's death. The police heard the word racist and their training kicked in. Had the police taken a few moments to assess the crime scene in a neutral and reasoned manner, Henry Novak may still be alive, as he would have received medical attention sooner. What's more, when Vikram Digwa was finally arrested and charged, despite the fact he weaponized the issue of race to the detriment of his victim, proving he was thinking about race and ethnicity at the time of the murder, he was not charged with a racially aggravated offence. This ensured that even if he was found guilty at trial, he would never face the harshest sentence that he could have faced. Finally, after being found guilty and being sentenced, the judge made clear that the starting point for Digwa's sentencing would begin at the lowest possible jail term, life with a minimum term of 15 years, partly because of his ethnicity, which granted him the privilege of carrying a deadly weapon, and which led to the judge concluding that it was possible that Digwa had a good legal reason for having the dagger. These systemic issues of anti-white bias are a far greater problem than the issue of one liberal judge, yet it is these issues which are being ignored by many of those who are calling for justice. But of course, it doesn't have to be one or the other. This could well be the case of a liberal judge who holds anti-white biases and use the legal system to administer two-tier justice, ensuring a lenient sentence was passed down with a legally sound justification. We will never truly know what Judge William Mousley was really thinking, but what we do know is that if he wanted to show a bias toward Vikram Digwa, he could do so lawfully thanks to the terrible legislation enacted by successive governments. It is this legislation that we should be primarily targeting, as it is this legislation that allows two-tier justice to be administered legally. As an important note, all the pieces of legislation mentioned, the Criminal Justice Act 1988, the Offensive Weapons Act 2019, and the Race Action Plan, introduced in 2022, were enacted under Conservative governments. Further note, racially aggravated offences were introduced in 1998 by Blair's Labour government. Judges are human, and as such, they will have their own opinions, political leanings, and biases. A good and fair legal system is crafted in such a manner that it does not allow a judge to pass down a judgment which can be influenced by any such personal bias. The Sentencing Council guidelines, coupled with anti-white legislation and selectively applied aggravating charges, create a system that is open to abuse and that results in unfair and unequitable outcomes. As such, two-tier justice is systemic in its nature. It is not confined to outlying cases, nor is it a localized issue based on whether a defendant sits in front of a liberal judge. Two-tier justice is baked into the system, a feature of the English legal framework rather than a failing. And when two-tier justice and a biased liberal judge collide, it results in horrible outcomes. But sadly, those horrible outcomes are completely legal and are delivered within the scope of the law. Crucially, justice can never be achieved for white Britons when we live under a system that was designed to create an outcome of inequalities that disenfranchises white Britons and places them at the bottom of the ethnic totem pole. To achieve justice and to restore the English justice system would require a complete overhaul of the current legal frameworks and the scrapping of laws that create discriminatory outcomes. But one would not be well advised to hold their breath waiting for Suella Braverman, or any sitting MP for that matter, to call for such an overhaul. Instead, the cries for justice that come from the mainstream, while still welcome, will be limited to calling for political appointees who are part of the system to scrutinise decisions that were made lawfully by said system. At some point, the discerning individual must rightfully conclude that it is not just a few bad eggs working within the system that are the problem, but the entire system itself. Part 3. The Conservative Policies That Killed Henry Novak. The leader of the Conservative Party, Olukemi Olufunto Adegoke Badenoch, better known as Kemi, spent the majority of last week on a whirlwind media tour telling anyone that would listen that it was herself and the Conservatives that were at the forefront of the fight to bring back common sense and colourblind policing. This is a line that is being trotted out by many Conservatives, with the implication being that Henry Novak's death was due to Labour Party policy. This is, of course, complete nonsense. every single piece of legislation, national policy initiative, or strategic guidance that helped contribute to Henry Novak's death and allowed for the lenient sentencing of his murderer was passed or implemented by a Conservative government. This is the elephant in the room, and the truth that both Badenoch and the Conservative Party don't want the public to be aware of. Badenoch's media blitz reached its peak when on June 4th, 2026, the Daily Mail ran an article titled, "Henry Novak's Family Want Common Sense Policing to Bring Society Together," says Kemi Badenoch, as murdered teen's parents leave Downing Street following meeting with Keir Starmer. This article was little more than a puff piece for Badenoch, even going as far as to include the full text of a post she made on X to press the point that it is her and the Conservatives who are at the forefront of the battle against woke policy. Part of Badenoch's post on X reads as follows.
"We must also be prepared to examine, carefully and seriously, religious practices or exemptions that permit the carrying of dangerous weapons in public and other activities that are not conducive to the public good. We also need to examine where the law needs to change. Henry's family do not want anger to tear communities apart. They are a family who have friends across faith and race, and so did Henry. His family want his memory to help bring our society together. Everyone knows I have strong views about how we should deal with equality under the law. What the family agreed with me on is that we need to bring common sense back, and that is what we should all be fighting for."
This is all rather curious, as what Badenoch chose to omit from her post was that all the laws and pieces of police guidance that needed to change were in fact implemented by successive Conservative governments. And worse still, she was part of one of the Conservative governments in question. However, by her omission, the post reads as if she and her party were the ones needed to solve a problem of bad policy created and implemented by the Labour Party. Badenoch is clearly attempting to paint herself as a crusader against liberal policy, but this is all one giant misdirection. Bearing in mind what Kemi Badenoch is trying to claim, before we examine all the ways in which the Conservative Party has helped to create the conditions that contributed to the death of Henry Novak, it is first important to understand how embedded Badenoch was within the previous Conservative government. Whilst Badenoch would undoubtedly like the public to believe that she is a breath of fresh air, someone relatively new to politics who intends to breathe fresh life into the Conservative Party and as such is not culpable for its previous failings, this could not be further from the truth. Badenoch is 46 years old, being born in 1980 in Wimbledon, London, before spending most of her youth in Nigeria and the United States, before permanently relocating to Britain at the age of 16. She joined the Conservative Party in 2005 and was first elected to Parliament on June 8, 2017 as the MP for Saffron Walden, now North West Essex. Badenoch then appeared to be fast-tracked through the ranks of the party and has held a number of ministerial roles within the government, a total of seven in fact. Between 2019 and 2024, she served in the following positions: Parliamentary Under Secretary of State for Education, July 2019 to February 2020, Exchequer Secretary to the Treasury, February 2020 to September 2021, Minister of State for Equalities, February 2020 to July 2022. Minister of State for Housing, Communities and Local Government, September 2021 to July 2022. Minister for Women and Equalities, October 2022 to July 2024. Secretary of State for International Trade, September 2022 to February 2023. And Secretary of State for Business and Trade, February 2023 to July 2024. An impressive resume for someone who was first elected in 2017, what's more, concrete proof that Badenoch played an important role at the centre of the Conservative Party during a time when immigration was at an all-time high and numerous policies were implemented that undoubtedly contributed to the death and suffering of Henry Novak. The first piece of legislation that helped create the conditions that allowed Vikram Digwa to legally carry the knife that he used to kill Henry Novak was the Criminal Justice Act in 1988. The Criminal Justice Act 1988 was passed on July 28th of that year. At the time, Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister, Douglas Hurd was the Home Secretary, and Sir Patrick Mayhew was the Attorney General. At the time, Kemi Badenoch was only 8 years old and didn't even live in the UK, so it would be grossly unfair to in any way attribute the wrongdoings of the Thatcher government to her. However, it is fair to state that at the age of 25, she was happy to join the Conservative Party, either without the knowledge of their previous wrongdoings or because she simply didn't care what successive Conservative governments had done to the country. While she was not involved in the passing of this legislation, by joining the party, there is an implied approval of the organisation's past record. The Criminal Justice Act 1988 controls and limits the carrying of knives in public through Section 139, which makes it illegal to carry any sharply pointed or bladed article in a public place. However, Section 139(5)(b) of the Act creates a specific statutory defence if an individual is carrying the bladed article for religious reasons. This exception is what allowed Vikram Digwa to walk the streets of Southampton with not one, but two knives, a larger Shasta dagger that was worn openly in a sheath attached to a belt, and a smaller kirpan, worn on a cord around his neck and concealed under his clothing. It was the larger Shasta dagger that was used to stab Henry Novak 4 times and slash him once across the face. What's more, it was this legislation that allowed the judge presiding over the trial of Henry's murder to conclude that Vikram Digwa had a good legal reason for having the dagger on the night he killed Henry. This good legal reason was the exemption granted to him by the 1988 Conservative government's legislation. Whilst Badenoch can arguably be given a pass for the 1988 legislation, she cannot be granted a similar pass for the Offensive Weapons Act 2019. The legislation came into force on May 16, 2019, when Theresa May was Prime Minister, Sajid Javid was Home Secretary, and Geoffrey Cox was Attorney General. This act updates UK knife laws by introducing stricter definitions and expanding existing bans to private spaces while explicitly strengthening legal protections for Sikhs. The act creates a new offence by making it illegal to possess certain weapons, such as knuckle dusters, throwing stars, and zombie knives, even in private places like a home. However, the 2019 Act heavily clarifies and broadens the exemptions established in the 1988 Act to grant privileges to the Sikh community. Under Section 47, the Act amends the Criminal Justice Act 1988 to ensure that large ceremonial kirpans, such as traditional curved swords, are explicitly protected. The Act also creates a specific defence allowing individuals to possess these large curved swords in private for religious reasons and introduces a legal defence for giving or presenting a curved sword to another person during a Sikh religious ceremony or cultural event. Finally, the Act provides a defence for the supply and importation of these items as long as it is done strictly to make the sword available for a Sikh ceremonial event. Crucially, when the Offensive Weapons Act 2019 was passed into law, Kemi Badenoch was an elected Member of Parliament for the Conservative Party. As such, we know that Badenoch voted consistently in favour of the Offensive Weapons Bill as it progressed through the House of Commons between 2018 and 2019. Because the exemptions for Sikhs, allowing the possession and presentation of larger ceremonial kirpans, were explicitly backed by the Conservative government and cross-party consensus, Badenoch voted in line with her party to pass these provisions into law. It appears that in 2019, Kemi wasn't crusading for equality under the law or opposing the exemptions that granted the followers of foreign religions the right under English law to carry deadly weapons. In fact, quite the opposite. She was eagerly voting more anti-white legislation through Parliament. This easily verifiable truth shows that Badenoch knowingly backed two-tier policy as an elected MP. But obviously, it is not just the legislation that granted Sikhs the right to carry deadly weapons that led to the death of Henry Novak. The most shocking and upsetting factor in Henry's death was the way in which the police treated him as he lay dying from the stab wounds inflicted upon him by Vikram Digwa. The police attending the scene immediately took the testimony of Henry's killer as gospel and proceeded to handcuff and arrest Henry whilst mocking his pleas for help. As Henry begged for his life, police body cam footage recorded one of the arresting officers mockingly stating, "You've been stabbed! Whereabouts? I don't think you have, mate!" As the police forced Henry's arms up behind his back, his pale white hand can be seen almost totally drained of blood, as clearly the bleeding from his wounds had caused his extremities to turn white. But both Henry's pleas and the physical evidence was ignored by officers. And crucially, this is because those officers were following police policy. Policy that was written and came into force under the previous Conservative government. The police policy that led to the horrific treatment of Henry Novak stems from a document called the Police Race Action Plan, which was initially released in draft form in May 2022. Before being rolled out to police forces between 2023 and 2024. In 2022, when the draft of the Police Race Action Plan originally surfaced, it was Boris Johnson, who was Prime Minister, Preeti Patel was the Home Secretary, and Suella Braverman was the Attorney General. It is this national strategic policy which specifically forced officers at the scene to behave in the way that they did. A little due diligence immediately reveals that the Police Race Action Plan was drafted when Kemi Badenoch was a government minister and rolled out to police forces when she was Minister for Women and Equalities. By 2022 and beyond, Badenoch was deeply embedded in the Conservative Party hierarchy, a fact made obvious when she succeeded Rishi Sunak as party leader, being elected to the role on November 2, 2024. Badenoch is now doing her best to distance herself from this strategic guidance, but not only was she a minister when this guidance was drafted and rolled out, but she is now the Conservative Party leader. But what she really doesn't want the public to know is that directly elected Conservative police and crime commissioners are still implementing the Police Race Action Plan to this day. The Police Race Action Plan is freely available online and is 57 pages in length. It is a sizeable document, and as such, analysing it in full and going into the minutiae of the guidance would be a topic worthy of a short book. The best place to start with the document is its core aims, which are to establish the police's commitment to a zero-tolerance policy when it comes to the issue of racism, and that police forces must be anti-racist in all that they do. It is important to note that this anti-racist policy is not the same as colour-blind policing. In fact, it is the opposite. The official guidance states that ensuring racial equity does not mean treating everyone the same or being colour-blind. Throughout the document, it is clear that the authors are not looking to bring about equality, but instead equity, which creates a system whereby people are treated differently depending on their racial or ethnic background, essentially creating the basis for the two-tier justice we see today in policing. The evidence of this can be found in the document from the very outset. Two telling quotes from the beginning of the plan can be found in the section titled Overview and illustrate exactly what the Police Race Action Plan is attempting to achieve.
Page 9. Policing recognizes that the racial disparities affecting black people are most acute, and the trust deficit presents a significant challenge to police legitimacy and effectiveness. This plan, therefore, focuses on improving policing for black people. When we say black people, we mean black African, black British, black Caribbean, black other and mixed black backgrounds. Disparities also exist in policing's relationships with other ethnic minorities, including the UK's Asian communities and Gypsy, Roma and Traveller communities. We do not intend to minimise these issues. The plan is in addition to ongoing efforts to ensure that policing is inclusive and fair to all, and that concerns from minority or underrepresented groups are acted on. Page 11. The plan seeks to create an anti-racist culture, values and behaviours within policing. This will inform all operational policing practice, improving the experience and outcomes for black people. It will enable the experiences of our black communities, officers and staff to have a direct influence on our policies and practices going forward.
These two quotes set the tone for the rest of the document. They clearly establish a need to address the concerns of every racial and ethnic group in Britain, with the notable exception being the concerns of white Britons. What's more, the authors of the document make it clear that the thought process, which aims to create an anti-racist culture, must be implemented at all levels of operational policing practice. This is not a document intended to be read by higher-ups, merely to be paid lip service at specially convened diversity training days, but instead, this is a piece of strategic guidance that informs officers at every level of the police hierarchy on how they should approach their day-to-day policing tasks. The document makes it very clear that the guidance affects and should inform frontline officers, such as the ones attending the scene of Henry Novak's murder. Throughout the document, there are many instances of what appears to be anti-racist or woke jargon, words and phrases that we have all heard many times. However, the issue is understanding how such words and phrases are interpreted by frontline officers and how everyday policing has changed thanks to this guidance. One phrase that everyone will be aware of is zero tolerance. But how does this actually affect the way in which officers behave? Thanks to zero tolerance, under the Police Race Action Plan guidelines, allegations of racism are classified as critical incidents that require immediate aggressive intervention. The training and culture surrounding the plan heavily emphasise that officers must not doubt individuals from ethnic minority backgrounds when they report some form of racial hostility. The application of this is both frightening and obvious. When a person from an ethnic minority background reports a racial crime, officers are trained to take the word of the person reporting the crime rather than challenging that person and demanding evidence. This immediately places an incredible and overriding weight on a claim of racism, and as such places Indigenous Britons at a significant disadvantage to ethnic minorities when dealing with the police. This zero tolerance policy had a chilling and deadly effect on the night of Henry Novak's murder. When Vikram Digwa falsely claimed that he was the victim of a racist attack, officers were culturally and operationally conditioned to treat that specific verbal claim as an overriding priority, effectively bypassing standard scepticism or objective fact-checking at the scene. This can be seen in the police body cam footage. Despite Henry Novak being the person on the floor pleading that he had been stabbed, all the officers at the scene took the side of his killer, believing his lies and acting on his directions. Officers went as far as to restrain and handcuff Henry, even though his hands were visibly ice white. Henry Novak then slipped into an unconscious state whilst wearing police handcuffs, his last experience in life being his arrest. This must have not only added an even greater degree of stress to his final moments, but it was also a clearly and deeply degrading act, one which the officers were more than happy to play their part in. Whilst it is likely that Kemi Badenoch would like people to believe that these horrendous actions were indicative of a small but unrepresentative group of woke officers, that is absolutely not the case. Police officers have not only been told to act in this manner, but have also been incentivized to behave this way. Police forces and individual officers face intense institutional scrutiny regarding how they handle interactions with members of minority communities. Officers are routinely audited on their compliance with diversity, equity, and inclusion guidelines, which were put into place as a result of the Police Race Action Plan. Officers who fail to immediately and robustly act on an allegation of racism, even an unverified one, face a high risk of internal disciplinary action. An officer who does not comply with this guidance runs the risk of being labelled institutionally racist, or even faces the prospect of being at the centre of a public scandal. The Police Race Action Plan has created an operational environment where officers prioritise ticking compliance boxes over assessing physical reality. In effect, the crime scene itself and the physical evidence that is immediately on hand and clearly visible becomes less important to arresting officers than the testimony of someone from an ethnic minority background. When officers arrived at the scene of Henry's murder, Vikram Digwa immediately introduced the issue of race, claiming he had been the victim of a racial attack. However, it wasn't just Digwa who will have introduced the issue of race on the night of Henry's murder. Police officers are trained not to treat everyone in the same way, and colourblind policing is something that the guidance specifically condemns. As a result, the implementation of the guidance has forced all officers to actively view situations through a racial lens rather than an objective one. This distorts any immediate risk assessment at a crime scene by placing greater emphasis on issues of race and ethnicity rather than the traditional emphasis on risk. On the night of Henry Novak's murder, officers were clearly more concerned with the racial dynamics and the optics of how they handled an ethnic minority suspect at the scene rather than the visible, life-threatening physical trauma being suffered by Henry Novak. When the guidance talks of equity over equality, this is the real-world outcome. Equity is a white boy bleeding to death in handcuffs as police politely listen to his killer's false claims. Frontline policing experts have repeatedly noted that the Police Race Action Plan places an intense focus on racial politics, and as a result, it has created a climate of fear on the streets for arresting officers. Police officers frequently second-guess their actions when dealing with minority individuals out of fear that using force or showing scepticism will be interpreted as a form of systemic bias. This leads to dramatic overcompensation and hesitation, which in this case led to officers entirely deferring to Vikram Digwa's false narrative to avoid any perception of prejudice, resulting in the catastrophic failure to provide basic first aid to Henry Novak as he lay dying in handcuffs. Just as Vikram Digwa knew that his best option was to concoct a false narrative about race, the arresting officer knew they had to believe that narrative and act upon it immediately and decisively. Whilst the Police Race Action Plan talks about combating systemic bias, instead, it has created anti-white systemic bias in every aspect of policing. It is this bias that contributed to Henry Novak's death. This all goes to prove that the operational doctrine found within the Police Race Action Plan is not only grossly flawed, but it is also anti-white, and by extension, creates a system of two-tier justice. By dictating that officers must prioritise anti-racism work and take a zero-tolerance approach to racism, the guidance grants an unbelievable privilege to those from an ethnic minority background. Once a person from an ethnic minority background makes the claim of racism at the scene of a crime, arresting officers are effectively duty-bound to believe said claim and take it more seriously than any other physical evidence or testimony. with scepticism itself being the potential grounds for disciplinary action. This ensures that when the police are called, white Britons will always come off worse when they are engaged in a hostile interaction with someone from an ethnic minority background, and all because of guidance introduced by the Conservatives. But shockingly, this strategic guidance and its implementation is not something that ceased to be under the control of the Conservative Party when they were voted out of power in the 2024 general election. On November 15th, 2012, the Conservative government introduced directly elected police and crime commissioners, PCCs, in England and Wales following the Police Reform and Social Responsibility Act 2011 becoming law. This new legislation replaced the old, unelected police authorities with new directly elected PCCs who would serve four-year terms. Amongst other things, directly elected PCCs set local police strategy, control budgets, and appoint and dismiss police chiefs. One of the ways the Conservatives sold this new elected position was by telling the public that they would now be able to vote for a PCC and thus be able to influence how local policing would be managed. This means that even after 2024, the Conservatives, whilst no longer the party of governance, were in charge of a number of police constabularies. Henry Novak was murdered in Southampton, a city that falls under the Hampshire and Isle of Wight constabulary. The directly elected PCC for this constabulary is Donna Jones. When the Police Race Action Plan was launched, she gushed with approval over the new strategic guidance, writing the following as part of a press release published on May 24th, 2022.
The public expects policing to be proactive in tackling racism in all its forms, to support victims of hate crime, to be more effective at engaging with black and Asian minority ethnic communities, to be subject to proper scrutiny, and crucially, to expose and deal with any remaining people working in policing who are racist. Hampshire and the Isle of Wight Constabulary is focused all of these things. The force continues to be proactive in rooting out all discriminatory behaviours, including racism. High-profile cases help to evidence this. We are proud that recent examples have been exposed as a result of police officers and police staff reporting this vile behaviour. Being anti-racist, ethical and inclusive is top of our agenda. Our approach is ambitious and meets the expectation in the National Plan, Hampshire Constabulary's Race Action Plan, and the expectation set down by the Police and Crime Commissioner. We already have more than 500 advocates committed to tackling racism, and we are training others to do the same. We welcome scrutiny in this area from independent representatives of our local communities and other independent bodies.
It's nice to know that Donna Jones's top priority was not solving crime, but instead committing her constabulary to strategic guidance that helped kill a white boy and ensure that his final moments were more harrowing and humiliating than they otherwise would have been. But interestingly, had that quote not been attributed to a conservative, the average and undiscerning reader may well incorrectly conclude that it had been penned by a member of the Labour Party or the Liberal Democrats. This raises another important and glaring issue, that the Conservatives are not just stumbling through a political minefield of liberal policy, going with the flow in order to ensure they are not blown to pieces for opposing legislation they don't actually agree with. That would, of course, be merely cowardly. Instead, it is worse. The Conservatives are just as eager to pass anti-white policy as their supposed counterparts in Labour, and what's more, they will cheer on such policy, enthusiastically embracing it and championing it at every opportunity. On June 2, 2026, after the conclusion of the trial of Vikram Digwa for the murder of Henry Novak, and without a hint of irony, Donna Jones released a statement in relation to circumstances surrounding Henry Novak's death. On the website of the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Constabulary, a press release stated,
Donna Jones. The PCC has also said the inspectorate should examine the training provided to frontline officers responding to knife crime incidents, including the application of immediate first aid and the physiological presentation of serious internal bleeding. The adequacy and regularity of that training will also be reviewed, and how officers are trained to triage competing accounts at the scene of a violent incident. Specifically, whether the provision of immediate medical assistance is treated as an unconditional duty that operates independently of any assessment of culpability.
Maybe she is suffering from amnesia, but Ms. Jones seems to have forgotten that it was in fact the National Strategic Guidance that she embraced and championed so enthusiastically that helped contribute to the death of Henry Novak. It was the very guidance that Donna Jones cheered on that forced officers to humiliate and degrade Henry Novak as he was dying. But the Conservatives hope that will all be forgotten, as now, being anti-racist, ethical and inclusive is no longer top of the agenda, as it is now time for the Conservatives to put on the anti-woke mask and rebrand themselves as the solution to the problem they in fact created. And of course, as Labour happens to be in power, it is all too easy to imply that this is a problem of their making. Please note, however, that whilst this national guidance was not passed under a Labour government, I am sure that every sitting Labour MP absolutely approves of it, and in no way should this be seen as an endorsement of the Labour Party or the suggestion that they are in any way a better option than the Conservatives when it comes to passing policy. Interestingly, these two paragraphs lifted from Donna Jones's press release reveal a shocking piece of information relating to the current police guidance, that the provision of immediate medical assistance is not treated as an unconditional duty. In other words, immediate medical assistance is, thanks to the Police Race Action Plan, a secondary consideration to police officers attending a crime scene if an allegation of racism has been made. This admission literally states that saving the life of a white person is less important to police than the allegation that said white person may have said something of a racially charged nature to a member of an ethnic minority community. Such an assertion would once have been described as dangerous hyperbole or even a conspiracy theory, but here it is, in writing, as part of a press release issued on an official government website for an elected PCC. And crucially, this is the work of the Conservative Party. But there is one other interesting issue relating to Donna Jones, as mentioned earlier, as PCC for the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Constabulary, she has the power to appoint and dismiss the police chief. The current police chief for Hampshire and the Isle of Wight is Alexis Boone, a man selected and appointed by Donna Jones. In the wake of the murder of Henry Novak, Alexis Boone has been extremely vocal in defending the police force and has strongly rejected allegations of two-tier policing or systemic bias. Whilst Boone issued a formal apology to the family of Henry Novak, he firmly denied that the case pointed to a deeper structural failure or anti-white bias within law enforcement, going as far as to state, "I don't accept the term of two-tier policing, I don't recognise it." Further to this, when asked if he believed UK policing has become anti-white due to its anti-racism policies, Alexis Boone replied, "No, I don't." Will Donna Jones use her power to dismiss Alexis Boone? Only time will tell, but if the Conservatives did truly care about this case, the first step would be to appoint a police chief who at least acknowledged that the problem of anti-white two-tier justice actually exists. The Conservative Party is no longer the party of governance, they are the official opposition. As such, they are attempting to rebrand themselves as the party that rejects woke politics. The irony is that it was the Conservative Party that passed the legislation and implemented the national guidelines that helped to seal Henry Novak's fate. The Conservative Party may not have stabbed Henry Novak to death, but they ensured that his killer was legally able to walk the streets with the knife that was used as a murder weapon, whilst at the same time banning white Britons from owning similar daggers and weapons, even within the privacy of their own homes. It was also not the Conservative Party that placed the handcuffs on Henry Novak's blood-drained wrists, but it was national guidance drafted and implemented under their rule that effectively forced the police officers attending the scene of his stabbing to do so. Kemi Badenoch is attempting to position herself and her party as crusaders for colourblind justice and common sense policing, but the fact is that it was Conservative Party policies and legislation that led to the death of Henry Novak, something she is careful not to mention. Worse still, Henry Novak died in a police constabulary that is overseen by a Conservative PCC, an issue that is now compounded by the fact that the local police chief appears to be doubling down on the very guidance that led to the inhumane treatment of Henry Novak at the hands of local officers. The tragic death of Henry Novak not only exposes anti-white two-tier justice, but shines a light on the fact that Kemi Badenoch and the Conservatives are nothing more than political opportunists who will say whatever they need to in order to gain power, whilst refusing to ever acknowledge that they in fact passed the policy which created the problem at hand. Whilst both Labour and the Conservatives are in many ways equally horrible, there is something about the Conservative Party that makes it arguably worse than the Labour Party. Whilst generally people know what they are getting with Labour, they expect a Labour government to be more liberal, to be more left-leaning on issues of race, immigration, and nationality. Many people are routinely fooled by the Conservatives. There are still people out there who think that Kemi Badenoch is the one who could sort this mess out, whilst being blissfully ignorant over the fact that she was happy to vote through legislation that strengthened laws which allowed Henry Novak's killer to walk the streets legally bearing weapons. Badenoch will now continue to reinvent herself as the anti-woke crusader who can save Britain, despite the fact that it is her party that has passed some of the worst anti-white legislation and currently holds the record for the highest level of net migration this country has ever witnessed. The same politicians who once crowed about the Police Race Action Plan and cheered on legislation that carved out exceptions that allowed an armed Sikh to legally walk the streets before murdering a white boy are now crying crocodile tears, calling for inquiries and claiming that it is the Conservatives who offer the solution. There is an old criticism of the Conservatives that they conserve nothing. This, however, is far too kind, as the Conservatives are often the party that passes the most appalling legislation. The Conservative Party is not the solution to the problem of anti-white two-tier justice. Quite the opposite, they are the architects of the legislation that brought it about. To suggest that the solution to a problem can be found amongst those who created the problem in the first place is as laughable as it is insulting. As such, Kemi Badenoch and the Conservatives deserve to be confined to the history books just as much as Keir Starmer and the Labour Party.